From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Billy Beane's rules for baseball. Writer Michael Lewis tells us how general manager Billy Beane of the Oakland A's rejected conventional wisdom about baseball stats and assembled a winning team of overlooked and undervalued players. Last year, they won 20 games in a row to set a new American League record. Michael Lewis's new book about the Oakland A's is called Moneyball: The Art of Winning an Unfair Game. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Friendship, the new recording from trumpeter Clark Terry and drummer Max Roach. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has signed a bill designed to cut taxes by $330 billion over the next 10 years. He called the cuts a common-sense approach to helping an economic recovery.
The best way to have more jobs is to help the people who create new jobs, and those are the small business owners of America.
Gene Sperling, a former economic advisor in the Clinton administration, said the tax cut package gives far more money to the wealthy than it does to middle and low-income workers.
58% of the benefits go to the top 1%. For that middle quintile of families, the dividend will average $20.
Sperling said the wealthy are less likely to spend their tax savings. The White House says President Bush plans to meet with the prime ministers of Israel and the Palestinians during a trip to the Middle East next week. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president plans to meet individually with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. If all goes well, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice told reporters, the three leaders will sit down together.
We believe that we're at a place where this meeting is likely to be very helpful. And so the president is simply saying that he will assess, but he fully believes that he's going to be able to go forward.
It's Mr. Bush's most direct involvement in the Middle East peace process and comes at a time when the administration is pushing for its roadmap that envisions a Palestinian state as early as 2005. The day before, the president will meet with Arab leaders in Egypt. Brian Naylor, NPR News, The White House.
Amnesty International charged in its annual report today that the war in Iraq and the war against terror have distracted attention from human rights abuses in many countries. NPR's Rina Advani reports.
The report says the Philippine and Ethiopian governments have received increased U.S. assistance for their support of the war in Iraq, despite human rights problems in their own countries. And Amnesty International's USA Executive Director, William Schultz, charges that with attention focused on Iraq, the civil war in Congo has gone largely ignored.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a lethal situation continues to descend into even greater brutality, with nearly 4.5 million lives lost in a conflict that has drawn in 10 neighboring countries.
The organization also cited Chechnya, China, Colombia, Israel, and Yemen as places where worsening human rights situations are cause for concern. Rina Advani, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 12 points to close at about at 87.93 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 6 points to close at 1,563. This is NPR News. A federal jury in Miami has convicted Fabio Ochoa on charges of conspiracy to smuggle drugs into the U.S. Ochoa, who's 46, was a leader of the Medellin drug cartel in Colombia during the 1980s, but he was given amnesty after serving 5 years in Colombian prisons. U.S. prosecutors charged that Ochoa got back into the drug business and was part of a ring that smuggled as much as 30 tons of cocaine per month into the U.S. in the late 1990s. Ochoa's defense argued that the prosecution case relied mostly on testimony from drug traffickers who were cooperating with the government in hopes of getting lighter sentences. Ochoa could face life in prison when he's sentenced in August. Rapidly expanding suburbs and heavily irrigated farms may be producing some of the heat that's now attributed to the greenhouse effect. NPR's John Nielsen reports.
On hot summer days, asphalt roads and concrete sidewalks soak up huge amounts of solar radiation, pumping it back into the atmosphere when the sun goes down. This has long been known as the heat island effect. In a new study, Eugenia Calnay of the University of Maryland argues that these heat islands have grown much larger over the last 50 years as cities have sprawled and intensive farming operations, which have a similar effect, have spread. After examining temperature readings from all over the United States, Calnay concluded that some of the warming attributed to the greenhouse effect was actually produced by these heat islands. Critics of the study say it's based on questionable satellite readings. The study appears in the new edition of the journal Nature. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 2 points to close at 953. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the economic development partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy. On the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. When Michael Lewis started researching his new book, Moneyball, he had a simple question. How did the Oakland A's, a motley collection of baseball misfits and utility players with the second lowest payroll in all of baseball, win so many games? The answer lies, as it often does in baseball, with statistics. In this case, a very creative and unusual use of statistical analysis on the part of the A's general manager, Billy Bean. Bean paid attention to numbers collected over the years by a group of baseball enthusiasts, including software engineers, physics professors, and Wall Street analysts, numbers that most everyone else in baseball ignores. These stats enabled Bean to discern the unique talents of undervalued players no one else wanted. He then assembled and regrouped them on the field according to their strengths, eventually pulling together a winning team last year. Michael Lewis followed the A's through the 2002 season. He's also the author of Liar's Poker and The New Thing. Terry asked Lewis to talk about the prevailing wisdom that teams with the most money to spend on players win the most games.
Well, the American League West, which has Oakland, the Seattle Mariners, the Anaheim Angels, and the Texas Rangers in it, finished in exact inverse relation to the amount of money the team spent on players. I think Oakland spent $40 million and won 103 games. Anaheim won a few games less and spent $20 million more. Seattle won a few games less than that and spent $20 million more than Anaheim. And Texas won 20 or 30 games less than everybody, and they spent, I don't know, $110, $115 million of some vast sum of money. So that was... Anybody who believed that money bought success in baseball would have been perplexed by how the American League West finished.
Okay, so we're talking about money in baseball, and you've pointed out that the discrepancy between the richest and the poorest of the baseball teams is bigger than the discrepancy, the financial discrepancy, in any of the other sports like basketball or football. Why is it so big in baseball? Is there a reason for it?
Yes, because the teams have never agreed to share revenues with each other. They share modest amounts of revenues, but in the other sports, there's more central control of the sport, and the teams have all agreed that it's for the good of the sport. That the best thing that the teams that are naturally richer, which would be, you know, for example, the New York teams, the big market teams, would share a lot of what they get from, say, their local media contracts. With the other teams, in baseball, the principal source of the discrepancy between the teams is local media contracts. So the New York Yankees get, I don't know, a couple of $100 million a year for their local television rights, which they're not obliged to share with the other teams in baseball. And the Oakland A's, which have a small media market, get $10 or $15 million a year for their local broadcast rights. And it's a combination of the owner's resistance to the idea of sharing revenues and the players' resistance to the idea that the owners would share revenues. The players have been adamantly opposed to Major League Baseball forcing the richest teams to share their loot with the poorest teams because they think that the net effect on players' salaries will be to decrease them.
You attribute a lot of the Oakland A's success to its general manager, Billy Bean. What kind of shape was the team in when he took over the team?
It was a losing team when he took over in 1997. And it's gotten better every year under his stewardship. And Billy Bean came into the organization and embraced the idea that there was such a thing as new knowledge in baseball, and you could research baseball and find out interesting things about it by researching it, and that the way baseball teams were conventionally run had all sorts of inefficiencies in it that could be exploited for profit. And so you've got essentially one team that's living purely by its wits and making a good run of it.
So the new knowledge, as you put it, that he was trying to find or to create in baseball was based in part on new baseball statistics and new ways of measuring the performance of players. What made him look at statistics more carefully and look for new ways of creating statistics?
Well, his predecessor in the job at Oakland, a fellow named Sandy Alderson, who's now works in the commissioner's office, had discovered Bill James, the baseball writer, who in the late 70s and early 80s published a series of what he called abstracts, where he systematically challenged the conventional wisdom of baseball, the traditional way baseball was played on the field, the traditional way of ways of evaluating baseball players. And while the Oakland A's have not sort of aped Bill James and taken everything he said and applied it to their system, they embraced the idea that's sort of central to James's work, that just because everybody does it a certain way doesn't mean it's right, and that you can use statistics to sort of dig below the surface of baseball and find the hidden game and find attributes, for example, in players that are very important but not highly valued in the marketplace, and also find attributes in players that teams pay a lot for that actually aren't worth that much when it comes to victory and defeat.
What are some of the Bill James statistical creations that changed the thinking of the A's?
Well, as I say, it's the spirit of James more than the specifics, but in his early works, James does something, you know, would seem commonsensical. He builds a model, a statistical model, to explain where runs come from. You know, how important is a walk or a single or a double or a triple in creating runs? And what he would do is take all the singles and doubles and triples and walks that, say, the Boston Red Sox in 1975 had and try to figure out and try to predict how many runs the Boston Red Sox would score on the basis of that. And so he developed this predictive model that was actually quite good. I mean, he could see that he could see how important these offensive attributes were, these offensive statistics were. And he quickly came to the conclusion that batting average, for example, which is held out, was maybe the chief way to evaluate the effectiveness of a hitter, was less important than on-base percentage. And the big difference between batting average and on-base percentage is how often a player walks. And so that the Oakland A's take this, and they go out and look for players who walk a lot but don't have gaudy batting averages. So they aren't very expensive, but they generate this thing that's very valuable called on-base percentage. But an awful lot of what the Oakland A's do is actually now proprietary to the Oakland A's. They sort of embraced the spirit of James, and they created their own kind of research and development program within the organization to generate proprietary information.
Two of the guys who created one of the systems that the Oakland A's have used were from a stock market background. They analyzed and traded derivative securities, and they came up with their own baseball statistics.
No, that's right. They were two traders from the Chicago Exchange whose job had been analyzing complicated securities, and they realized that the sort of thinking they were doing about securities could be applied to baseball players. And they set out to essentially strip out the luck factor from players' performances. So if you take a simple example, a hitter hits a double, and he's credited with a double in the record books of baseball, and his value goes up a little bit because doubles are valuable. But what these guys recognized was that's really not adequate if you want to price what the value of what the guy has done. Because not all doubles are alike. They're sort of fly balls that get lost in the sun that should have been outs, and those really shouldn't be scored as doubles. They should be something in the credit book for this player. They should be something else. And then there are screaming line drives that normally would be doubles. And, you know, just because there was some sensational outfielder who happened to be there or some luckily positioned outfielder, they get caught and they become outs. And what they did is they took everything that happened on a baseball field and reduced it to, sliced it and diced it to its most elemental parts. And they said, this is the true value of that event. And so we're going to credit that value to this player's account. And the end result was coming up with very different valuations for players' performances than the conventional wisdom. And this is basically what the Oakland A's are doing, too.
It's a very subjective way of being empirical. Because, you know, you're subjectively analyzing each play and, like, who gets the credit for it, and then you're converting it into this empirical number.
Well, it isn't that subjective, because what you're doing is comparing what happened on the baseball field to what normally happens. So what they would do is they would say, let's say Johnny Damon of the Boston Red Sox hits a line drive. They'd call it a ball hit at a certain velocity in a certain angle to the ground that landed in this little point on the baseball field. And they would say, well, balls hit like that over the past 10 years, what typically are they? And they would say, typically, they'd say 87% of the time they're doubles. So they'd say whatever had happened in that particular case with Johnny Damon's ball, that he should be credited with 87% of a double. So what they're trying to do is sort of eliminate the subjectivity. Instead of judging the thing that happened by the outcome, they're sort of looking at the process that led to the outcome. The end result of all this is that the Oakland A's are forced, because they don't have any money, to build a team from players out of players that the other teams don't value. Because if the other teams do value them, the Oakland A's can't afford them. So they're forced to find a way to find the hidden value in players. And that they have built this team out of players that other teams often had no interest in at all and always had much less interest in. And that this group of, you know, rejected parts from other organizations has come together and become this juggernaut on the field, it was to me the really astonishing thing.
Michael Lewis talking with Terry Gross. His new book, Moneyball, is about the Oakland A's baseball team. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, Terry's guest is Michael Lewis. His new book is Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game. It's about money and baseball and new strategies of measuring players' abilities. It tells the story of the 2002 Oakland A's and their manager, Billy Beane.
Why don't you describe how one of the players signed to the Oakland A's became a big success with the A's but hadn't been thought of as a great player before joining the A's?
There are plenty of examples, but let's take one of the characters in the book, Scott Hatterberg. Scott Hatterberg had spent 10 years in the Boston Red Sox organization, four of them in the minor leagues and I guess almost six of them in the big leagues. He'd been a catcher. And the Red Sox viewed him as a catcher who, you know, wasn't a disaster as a hitter. And that was because they didn't value what he did really well. What he did really well was he got on base way above the major league, at a rate way above the big league average, which is the single most important thing that a player can do. And in addition, and this is a more subtle virtue in a hitter, each of his plate appearances were inordinately drawn out. He would always see more pitches per plate appearance than just about any player in the league. And he rarely swung at pitches that were out of the strike zone. Now, the effect of this is to subtly wear down the opposing pitching. It's good for the team to have a team full of guys who don't swing at balls and who force the opposing pitcher to throw lots of pitches. But it's even better to have a team full of guys who get on base a lot. Anyway, the Oakland A's had seen this these qualities in Scott Hatterberg because they measured things like the number of pitches he saw per plate appearance, and they watched very closely for on-base percentage. And so they had been for several years praying that they could some way get their hands on Scott Hatterberg. Well, Scott Hatterberg had an accident during spring training with the Boston Red Sox and ruptured a nerve in his throwing elbow. And it basically meant he couldn't feel his hand. He had to relearn how to throw the baseball. He was finished from that moment on as a catcher, because you have to be able to throw as a catcher. And the Red Sox then tossed him on the scrap heap. They had no sense that he was valuable as a hitter. Well, Scott Hatterberg ends up becoming a free agent, and no one wants him. I mean, it's actually extraordinary. He becomes a free agent, I think it's 2 days before Christmas at midnight. And at 12:01, Paul DePodesta, the assistant GM of the Oakland A's, is on the phone to his agent saying, "We got to have this guy." And as his agent said, "Look, we were looking at a market where 29 teams regarded Scott as useless, and one team desperately wanted him." So Hatterberg became the first baseman of the Oakland A's last year. And he's been terrific. He's been a subtle but extremely important offensive player. And the reason they got him is that no one else saw the value in him. And because no one else saw the value in him, he was cheap. They didn't have to pay him very much.
And also, it seems like, you know, Oakland is using players differently than other teams might use them, because it's measuring their skills differently.
That's right. You know, one of the things they're doing in Oakland is identifying which traits in a baseball player are overpriced and which are underpriced. And the trait that is dramatically overpriced is foot speed. They say that, you know, the effect of speed on the game, you know, it is there. There are effects, but it's small in relation to what you pay for it. So as a result, they don't buy it. They don't buy fast guys, because fast guys get paid too much. And as a result, they're by far the slowest team in baseball. And that leads in turn to an even greater disdain for things like trying to steal bases or taking risks generally on the base paths. They would have that attitude towards base running anyway, because they have analysis that shows that trying to steal bases often doesn't, the rewards often don't justify the risk. But the fact that they have collected a group of people who can't steal bases anyway means they're not going to do it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Lewis, and his new book is called Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game. And it's about money in baseball, looking specifically at the Oakland A's and its manager, Billy Beane.
And you know, but to get back to, just to finish off the thought about Scott Hatterberg, what was great about this story, as I say, is that you had this collection of junkyard dogs, these underdogs that nobody else wanted, coming together to be a really great team. And often what was valuable about them as baseball players was hidden to the wider world. There was traits that were discerned by the Oakland front office that other people hadn't seen, but they were often also character traits. I mean, one of the questions, that's sort of the open question that they discuss often in the Oakland front office, is whether this quality that Scott Hatterberg had and has, plate discipline, they call it, which is so important in an offensive player, whether it's can be taught or whether it's in some way innate. And Billy Beane, the general manager of the Oakland A's, has come to the conclusion that it's innate, that basically, unless they could get a guy in diapers, by the time they become professional baseball players, they're almost hardwired to approach hitting the way they approach hitting. So the question I had when I, you know, get to know Scott Hatterberg and spend some time in his life is, what is it about him that makes him so patient, that makes him so disciplined and composed when he's in the batter's box, which in turn leads to his value? And this wonderful stuff comes out of it. You know, when I would spend an hour before every game with him reviewing tape of his performances and of the pitchers he was about to face. And there was one tape where he's facing a pitcher from the Seattle Mariners named Jamie Moyer. And he has he's already seen 7 or 8 pitches. There's a full count, and he's fouling off pitches. And Jamie Moyer, in disgust, steps off the mound and shouts something to him. And I said, what on earth is that about? And he said, well, it's a little weird, he said. But he was asking me what I wanted. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, just tell me what you want, and I'll throw it. That he was, his approach to hitting absolutely frustrated opposing pitchers because everything he did, he drew out their encounter for far too long in the eyes of the opposing pitchers. And I spent an awful lot of time just trying to get to the bottom of what it was inside of Scott Hatterberg that led him to do this.
And did you think you figured it out?
I think I figured out that what it was inside of him had been inside of him since he was a little boy. Because since he was a little boy, baseball coaches, little league baseball coaches, high school baseball coaches, college baseball coaches had tried to beat out of him this valuable approach. There is this strain of thinking in the game that if you're going to be a great hitter, you have to be aggressive. And people are always screaming at him to swing at things he didn't want to swing at. And he took refuge in a tape that the Yankees' famous first baseman, Don Mattingly, had made when Hatterberg was a boy. And it was a tape called How to Hit 300. And on this tape, Mattingly explains that it's important to be patient at the plate, that drawing lots of walks is a good thing for a hitter, that swinging at things that you can't hit hard, even if they're strikes, is a bad idea. This was the one thing that Hatterberg heard as a young baseball player that gave him the courage of his conviction. But he wanted to believe it anyway. It was, he said, I've always felt uncomfortable, swinging at the first pitch. I need to slow the game down before I can really play it. And I've always thought, I mean, another time he said, even when I was a little kid, when I'd swing at something that, you know, I really couldn't hit hard and I ground out to second base, it just struck me as a worthless experience. And it was an insistence that the game conform to his idea of what it should be, that to slow the game down, to kind of give it a kind of meaning.
Michael Lewis's new book is Moneyball. We'll continue Terry's interview with Lewis in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Universal Studios Home Video and Focus Features, presenting The Pianist, One Man's Struggle, and the Survival of the Human Spirit, available on DVD, and Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Cup of Light, a novel of art set in modern-day China by Nicole Mones. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording featuring trumpeter Clark Terry and drummer Max Roach. We're listening to it now. And we continue our interview with Michael Lewis about the Oakland A's general manager Billy Bean and his new approach to baseball.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's get back now to Terry's interview with Michael Lewis, author of the new book Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game. It's about the Oakland A's 2002 season, how despite being one of the financially poorest teams in baseball, they went on to break the American League West record for most consecutive wins. Lewis describes how general manager Billy Beane used unorthodox ways of assessing players' talents to assemble a winning team. For instance, he paid more attention to players' on-base percentage than their batting average. This radically influenced the kinds of players Beane hired.
You know, in talking about how Billy Beane signs new players, he gives you his rules for a shopping spree. What are some of his rules?
The first and most important rule, violated by many, many teams in big league baseball, is that the minute you feel like you have to do something, you're screwed. That you can always recover from the player you didn't sign, but you may never recover from the player that you did sign that you shouldn't have. And baseball is littered with teams that have signed putative superstars to huge contracts who then don't pan out. And the franchises are wounded or sometimes severely crippled by the fact that they don't have any money left to go and pay other players. And they're left with a superstar who's not performing and earning $80 million. In baseball, it makes much less sense to do this than in most sports because one guy on a baseball team rarely makes that much difference. It really is a team sport. So the notion that you've got to sign this superstar or that superstar is really a little silly. And that's the first principle of Billy Beane's school of management.
What's another one of his rules?
Number two is identify exactly who you want and go and get him. I mean, what they do is they use statistics to identify Scott Hatterberg or the pitcher named Chad Bradford who they got or any number of guys. And they say, this is the guy who has the value, the hidden value that we can afford. And I am going to relentlessly pursue the team he plays for until I get that guy. Now, so they don't go into trades with a kind of loose notion of what they want. They're very, very focused about what they want. And this is a big problem for them because Billy Beane has been so successful in the trades he's made in the last 3 or 4 years. He always seems to get so much more than he gives that other teams have become instinctively very wary about doing business with him. So if he wants a guy, he'll often find that the guy is magically not available. So he's had to find all kinds of clever ways to get the players that he wants because once he wants them, they're not his.
What's a clever way he found?
Well, what he does, he goes fishing. What he'll do. I mean, he did this. There's a long section in the book about a very improbably successful pitcher named Chad Bradford, who's a submariner who throws underhand, basically. Who was in AAA in the minor leagues with the Chicago White Sox, and who had been just deadly. Had been just wiping out opposing hitters. And yet the White Sox were refusing to move him to the big leagues. And Billy knew that if he called the White Sox GM and said, what do I have to give you to get Chad Bradford, that the price would have gone up to the point where he didn't want to do it. So instead, what he does is he calls the White Sox GM and he talks about how he has this catcher he might like to move because he needs to get a pitcher who might be a kind of 12th or 13th man on the staff, a guy who might be in the bullpen or might be shuffled between AAA, but someone, he just needed another arm, he said. And he asked the White Sox GM to recommend some names. And the first set of names didn't have Chad Bradford in it. So he goes back to him and says, can you recommend any more guys? And so eventually the White Sox general manager says, well, you know, I hate to even mention him because, you know, he only throws 82 miles an hour and he's called recently and said his back's not feeling so good, but there's this guy named Chad Bradford who's in AAA. And Billy, you know, says, oh, he'll do.
Right. So are other teams starting to use the Billy Beane approach to signing players?
In the offseason between 2002 and 2003, it was pretty clear that the dollars were starting to dry up. The market for baseball players was changing a little bit. And I think that is directly the influence of the Oakland A's. More specifically, the Toronto Blue Jays and the Boston Red Sox have, in the last year and a half, more or less openly said that they're reinventing themselves in the image of the Oakland A's. The Red Sox, just before the 2003 season, tried to hire Billy Beane to run them.
And they would have offered him a lot of money, too.
They actually had come to terms. Billy Beane had spent one day as the general manager of the Red Sox. He had accepted a deal that I think was going to pay him $12.5 million over 5 years, which is, I guess, more than anyone is being paid to run a baseball team. But he said he woke up the next morning and he didn't feel right, so he changed his mind.
Any regrets, do you think?
I don't think he regrets not going to the Red Sox. He might regret having taken it in the first place because it created a big stir in the newspapers. And I think he was a little embarrassed by how much noise it created. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think that part of what motivated him was that there is still a widespread lack of appreciation inside baseball for what this organization has done. I mean, it is astonishing the success that they have had with their resources. And because nobody thinks in terms of efficiency when they think in terms of running a baseball team. They just think in terms of did you win the World Series or not. And so the fact that they got bumped out of the playoffs in the first round and everybody's saying, oh, they're failures, it was nice for him to get the validation that to have some owner say, yes, I recognize that you are the best in the game. And I think that it was especially nice because the new owner of the Boston Red Sox is a fellow named John Henry, who made his fortune on Wall Street. And so Henry is a guy who sort of understands how markets work, and he's seen that sort of what he learned on Wall Street is equally applicable to baseball.
And doesn't that bother you just a little bit, that baseball is becoming so much like Wall Street and that players' performance is measured with these complex computerized programs? I know statistics have always played an important part in baseball, but, you know, it's getting so complexly calibrated and so like Wall Street in that respect.
It is true that the sport, that one of the influences of the Oakland A's is to intellectualize the sport. That is true. I can't say it bothers me, not because I have any particular fondness for intellectualizing the sport, but because I've seen the consequences. And the consequences are all these guys who previously were thought to have no value, whose value was missed because the sport was improperly understood, are being given their chance to have their day in the sun. I mean, it's a wonderful story. This collection of guys who, most of whom have been told their whole lives they were ill-suited for one reason or another, often because of the way they looked, because of the shapes of their bodies, to play big league baseball. That these guys have assembled and become this fighting force that is, when they take the field against three and four times the amounts of money, are regarded as the favorites. I mean, to me, that's inspiring. I mean, what I find depressing is the idea that you can just buy it, that the New York Yankees with their $140 million can just go buy success, and that it's so obvious who's the best that you can just buy them and put them on the field and they'll win. It is wonderful that there is still room for underappreciated, undervalued people to have that kind of success in the sport.
Michael Lewis's new book is Moneyball. We'll hear more of Terry's conversation with him after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to our interview with Michael Lewis. His book about the Oakland A's new approach to baseball is called Moneyball.
How did Billy Beane become a manager? He started as a player.
He began his life as a player. He spent 10 very frustrating years bouncing around the minor leagues and then on the benches of big league teams. And when he realized that the hopes and dreams of scouts had been misfocused upon him, that he really should not have been a player, that even though everybody thought he was going to be a superstar, he wasn't cut out to be a baseball player. He walks out of the dugout of the Oakland A's, where he was a fourth or fifth outfielder, and into the front office and asks for a job. He's 27 years old, at the peak, at which should be the peak of his playing career, and he's decided he doesn't want to play anymore. The front office had never seen anything like it. I mean, nobody walks out of a dugout and says, "I want to be a scout," or "I want to be employed. I want to be put on a suit and take a job here." So nobody quite knew what to make of it, but they gave him a job. And what had happened was, baseball had essentially rendered Billy Bean unfit for anything but itself. That he had not gone and gotten his education. He had a high school degree and no experience in anything but baseball. So, I mean, I think, as he put it, it bred a certain sense of desperation in himself. But he thought that he had seen enough of the game to know that there was an awful lot wrong with it, an awful lot of inefficiency in it. And he thought maybe he might make a career attacking that inefficiency and taking advantage of it. So he worked his way up within the front office of the Oakland A's, and his boss, the GM of the A's at the time, Sandy Alderson, made him his successor in 1997.
Do you think the fact that he used to be a baseball player himself has affected Billy Bean's relationship with the players on his team?
There's no question that that the fact that he played has a huge effect on his relationship with the players, because he most general managers don't loiter around the clubhouse. David Justice, who played for the A's last year, told me that he saw more of Billy Bean in one season than he'd seen of all the GMs put together in the previous dozen or so years combined in the big leagues. I mean, Billy Bean is maybe the one general manager in baseball who never sets foot in his luxury suite in the Oakland Coliseum. He spends all of his time in the clubhouse. I mean, he is he's very hands-on, and he's very comfortable mingling with the players. And the big thing is that there's an awful lot of he's not deterred by the mystique of a big league clubhouse. He doesn't have any use for it, and it's very hard for players and managers to buffalo him with big league baseball nonsense, because he's been there. He's played. He knows what's true and what's not. And oddly, you know, one of the strange things about the Oakland A's is that their general manager is perhaps the best athlete in the organization. I mean, he was a sensational natural athlete who was just not a great baseball player. And so when Billy Bean, and he still has that aura about him. He still feels like he still moves like a great athlete. And when he goes into the clubhouse, he often goes into the clubhouse to put on his sweats and hit the weight room or run on the treadmill. And I think he has a certain credibility with the players as a man among men.
Do you feel like you see baseball differently now that you've studied the management and the money end of it?
I tell you, the spending a year as a fly on the wall in the Oakland A's front office and in the clubhouse has had a couple of big effects on the way I just watch a baseball game. I mean, they have taught me to see it as a game of odds. And they've taught me to see that everything that happens on a baseball field changes the odds of what might happen. So first pitch strike, it lowers, and I have some sense of how much it lowers the odds that a hitter will get a hit, that it's going to end well for the hitter. First pitch ball, the opposite. Runner moving from first to second, what the likelihood that of that leading to a run. That the probabilistic nature of the game was something I dimly sensed before and am now acutely aware of. And that's one big effect it's had on me. The second is to humanize the players. I mean, I spent a lot of time working my way into the lives of several of the Oakland A's players. And it was fascinating to me to see the way they thought about the game. I mean, to see that, I mean, these guys were essentially lab rats in a science experiment in some way. And they were oblivious to the experiment, but they knew it was working, if that makes any sense.
One last question. Since the Billy Beane approach to signing new players takes into account talents that they have or abilities that they have that other people haven't really noticed, once they join the A's, that talent does get noticed, therefore they become more valuable, therefore another team might want to sign them, therefore the A's might not be able to afford to keep them anymore. Or the player might just, you know, because the player might demand a higher salary that the A's can't match. So have they already lost players, or do you think they're in danger of losing players because the players have become more valuable?
Oh, that's a great question. It's completely true. I mean, let's take an example. Jason Giambi, who they identified as an amateur player and drafted in the second round, who they identified as a good natural hitter, but he didn't actually have a lot of power, didn't hit a lot of home runs, and then comes to the A's and develops into this slugger. And the way baseball is structured is that a team that drafts a player basically has him as an indentured servant for the first 3 years of his career. The second 3 years is a kind of negotiation called arbitration, where they get him at below his market value. But at the seventh year, he can auction his services. He can become a free agent. And Jason Giambi did just this after the 2001 season. And he ended up getting about $120 million from the New York Yankees for 7 years. And the A's didn't even begin to compete for him. I mean, they pretended in the media as if they wanted to re-sign him. But they knew that if they invested this kind of money in a single player, they were putting the entire franchise at risk. Be in violation of Billy Beane's first rule of management. Don't put yourself in a position where one bad contract can ruin your future.
Has he done as well with the Yankees as he did with the A's?
No, not quite as well, but he's still been, this year he's been off to a soft start. But last year he was very good. But the interesting thing is that when he left at the end of 2001, everybody was saying, this proves that poor teams can't compete. This proves that the A's are doomed. Now they've lost one of their stars to free agency. They had won 102 games in 2001. They came back without Jason Giambi in 2002 and won 103 games. What they show is that even when you lose these stars because you can't afford to pay the market price for them, there are ways of replacing them. I mean, in the first place, players are more fungible than the market understands, that you can get guys from the minor leagues and you can get guys from other teams who can fill in the gaps that are left behind and do the job. What they understand is that that superstars can be replaced. If you understand what exactly it was that they contributed to your baseball team, you can often go and find those pieces in other players and reconfigure the team so that it is just as successful without him as it was with him. And this is one of the big points of the organization, that when you lose a star because he's able to auction his services, you don't try to replace the star. You try to replace the aggregate. You try to replicate the team you had, the aggregate statistics you had, with the star on the team. So it may mean moving a couple of other, replacing three players, and upgrading the team in other places. But they've done this now over and over again, and they will, you're right, continue to lose stars. But it looks like they can survive it.
Well, Michael Lewis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Lewis is the author of Moneyball. Coming up, a review of a new CD featuring drummer Max Roach and trumpeter Clark Terry. This is Fresh Air. Over the years, jazz drummer Max Roach has recorded duets with singer Abby Lincoln, pianist Abdullah Ibrahim, Cecil Taylor, and Connie Crothers, saxophonist Archie Shepp and Anthony Braxton, and trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie. Last year, at age 78, Roach recorded with former Ellington trumpeter Clark Terry. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Clark Terry and Max Roach from their CD, Friendship. Before recording it last year, these old friends and jazz heroes had hardly crossed paths in the studio. A 1954 jam with Clifford Brown and Dinah Washington, and one number with Thelonious Monk from 58 about covering. Clark Terry was 81 when he cut this session, which is getting up there for a working trumpeter, let alone one plagued by various ailments. He doesn't push himself as hard as he used to, but his sound is still plump and juicy as a big raspberry. Fascinating to hear how these crafty titans deal with aging, mostly a matter of pacing themselves. Roach isn't the firebrand he was, say, 26 years ago, when he recorded his duets with South African pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. Conveniently enough, that disc was just reissued to prompt the comparison. This is Max Roach in 1977. That was then. Now, with Clark Terry, Max Roach plays more sparely, but as he pares his style down, he lays bare its roots and dance rhythms. Roach likes to point out that one reason people didn't dance to bebop was a wartime entertainment tax that penalized jazz clubs with dance floors. But he still feels that severed connection. He phrases with the clarity and grace of a tap dancer. You can hear it on Brushes and Brass, where Clark Terry's blues expand on a pet trumpet lick. It's kind of short, so let's hear the whole thing.
Thank you.
The Clark Terry Max Roach CD also has some quartet, trio, and solo pieces, including what may be the trumpeter's only unaccompanied ballads on record. But the six duets are the heart of the program. Where some of Roach's earlier face-offs were epics, these meetings are more offhand, more sketches than masterworks, but old friends shouldn't get too formal with one another. They allude to shared experiences they don't have to refer to outright.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Friendship, the new CD featuring drummer Max Roach and trumpeter Clark Terry. The 1977 CD Streams of Consciousness has also been reissued, featuring Max Roach and Abdullah Ibrahim. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Seuss Boland directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Universal Studios Home Video and Focus Features, presenting The Pianist, One Man's Struggle, and the Survival of the Human Spirit, available on DVD. And from Wiley, publishers of The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group, Dan Brighty's investigation into the intersection of big business, government, and defense, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet filmmaker Chen Kaige. His new film, Together, follows a young violin player who travels to Beijing seeking fame, but plans change. Kaige also directed the Oscar-nominated film Farewell, My Concubine. Join us for the next Fresh Air.